This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Muhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The song is an entry point into the Zimbabwean discourse where people now talk about why is it there is a broken state in Zimbabwe? Why is it the roads are bad? Why is it people don't have clean drinking water? Why is it 95% of Zimbabwe's potential workforce is not going to work?
That was Zimbabwe's often arrested anti-corruption journalist Hopewell Chinono, who has issued a song called Dem Loot about corruption in the country. Details coming up. Also, the formation of a new interim unity government in Libya is being welcomed by world powers. And Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok announces a new cabinet with ex-rebels as ministers. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Africa is now putting its hopes on a vaccine developed by the Johnson & Johnson or J&J pharmaceutical company as it battles the COVID-19 pandemic, which is being driven by a more infectious variant of the virus. The government was forced to temporarily suspend its rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine to health workers on Sunday after trial results showed it was largely ineffective against the 501Y period V2 mutation. Darren Taylor has more.
Medical scientist Glenda Gray led a team that tested the J&J vaccine at 32 sites across South Africa. It's the only vaccine so far that requires a single shot. Others need a follow-up booster 6 weeks later. Gray says the J&J inoculation is called AD26.
We've already used this AD26 platform already, and we've used it extensively in Ebola, Zika, and some of the ongoing HIV vaccine trials in South Africa. Why is this AD26 vaccine important? It's important because it's stable at 2 to 8 degrees Celsius, which is the normal fridge temperature in our country.
The other vaccines need special refrigeration because they must be stored at extremely low temperatures, like minus 70 degrees Celsius. Gray says more than 43,000 people took part in the J&J trial in the United States, Latin America, and South Africa.
We had, importantly, lots of people over 60. A third of our participants were over 60, so we can answer the question about the elderly. 20% were over 65.
She explains that more than 40% of people given the test jab had comorbidities, conditions that make individuals very vulnerable to severe COVID-19.
Most of them had obesity or had diabetes or hypertension, and 2.8% of our participants had HIV, as well as other immunocompromised participants. This was important so we could get an understanding of how the vaccine worked in immunosuppressed people, including HIV-infected people.
The trial happened at a time when infection rates were high and new variants of the virus were emerging. Gray says J&J's teams of scientists have shown its vaccine works well to prevent moderate to critical COVID-19 infection. In South Africa, she adds, the shot was only 57% effective in preventing mild to moderate disease in people infected with the variant, but it was highly effective in preventing severe coronavirus and death in people who had the variant.
I think it's very important that we saw that the vaccine efficacy increased with the severity of the COVID-19 disease. So we saw high vaccine efficacy, 85%, 28 days after the shot.
South Africans are now clamoring for the J&J jab.
So how soon can we use this vaccine in South Africa? So I want to tell you that we are in advanced discussions to further evaluate single-shot Johnson COVID-19 vaccine in South Africa in an accelerated fashion. Over the next few days, we expect to announce a plan to expedite vaccinations using the Janssen investigational product in healthcare workers in South Africa.
Gray says the vaccine is safe. Therefore, she says J&J wants to give it to healthcare workers as part of a new study before it's officially approved by South Africa's medicines regulator.
Doing the study rapidly in healthcare workers allows us not only to help healthcare workers prevent severe disease, death and hospitalization, but also to help us understand the vaccine as we roll it out in South Africa.
According to J&J, it'll be able to connect very closely with the state's vaccine rollout program because it's already established research sites in most of the country's provinces. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
World powers have welcomed an agreement by Libya's rival political groups to form a new interim unity government headed by Abdul Hamid Dabiba, a powerful business person from the western city of Misrata. The surprise came when the self-styled Libyan National Army, led by Khalifa Haftar, congratulated the interim government through a UN brokered process. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Wolfgang Poshtai, former military attaché in Libya, about these developments and what it may mean for Libya's future.
I would not say that the situation is now much worse than before for Haftar as an individual. He was never ever on good terms with Sarraj. Allegedly, the Dabiba recently visited Benghazi and probably also talked with him. Saleh's influence is heavily undermined. This is also not too bad for Haftar, for his reputation in the East. LNA spokesman Ms. Mari said yesterday that the supreme commander of the LNA is the new presidential council. But for the real reaction, Haftar will wait and see what the new government will do, and how, especially how the people on the streets and the tribal leaders in the East will react. I would say, and this is my advice for the new government, regarding the Cyrenaica, this is not about getting Haftar as a person on board, but about getting the people in the East on board. Haftar will not act against what he perceives the will of the people and the will of the Eastern tribes.
Would he still be the chief of the army?
This is quite likely, because he will claim that he is appointed by the House of Representatives and not by the Supreme Commander. And I have no doubt that the House of Representatives, which is located in the East under Aguila Saleh, will still keep him as the commander, because they certainly share common interests with him.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi welcomed the new interim government in Libya and took credit for the red line he drew in Libya last year as a contribution to the progress in Libya. Is that a fair claim by Sisi?
I fully agree with him. Actually, his declaration, his credible declaration of the red line, certainly contributed to the stabilization of the front line. Operation Volcano, supported by Turkey, was about to attack Sirte and advance further on to the east. Actually, there were at least two major attempts of Operation Volcano to advance and take Sirte. If al-Sisi would not have declared his red line, I have no doubt that they would have made a major attempt to attack the east. And this could have, or I would even say, this would have certainly led to an escalation. Right now, regardless if the Dabiba government succeeds or not, right now, there is the chance of consolidation of the ceasefire. Because right now, everyone in the East and in the West, also among the military leaderships, supports the Dabiba and the UN, at least officially. And right now, this would be the perfect opportunity for a consolidation. This means to implement such a ceasefire monitoring, a civilian cease monitoring mission as proposed by UN Secretary Guterres. So this is the chance to achieve really a progress with regard to consolidation of the ceasefire. And this is maybe even more important than the current political developments.
The United States called on Turkey, Russia, and the United Arab Emirates to stop their military intervention.
This is a very wise move. And actually, I've advised already the previous government and some of my contacts in the current administration about this, that if you want to get rid of Russia in Libya, you need to make them unimportant for the East. The reason why they are there is because they are providing the backbone of the Air Force and technical support and so on and so on. They need this technical support in the Air Force as long as they are worried about an eventual attack from the West. If the ceasefire is consolidated, there would be no need for the Emirates to continue to pay for Wagner. I doubt that Russia would maintain its presence in Libya if they are not being paid by the Emirates. But they will only withdraw if Turkey also withdraws. So the demand by the Secretary of State that both shall withdraw makes absolutely sense. It is unlikely, and I would rule it out, that Turkey will withdraw and Russia stay. I would also rule out that Wagner will withdraw or the Emirates will stop paying for them if the Turks are still on the other side. So this is about allowing somehow Turkey to maintain its strategic interests in Libya, namely the economic interests. If Turkey is able to sustain its economic interests, to continue with the contracts and so on and so on, I would consider it really as realistic that they will withdraw the majority of their footprint in Libya.
That was Wolfgang Porstai, former military attaché in Libya, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Following a peace deal in October aimed at ending decades of war, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok yesterday announced a new cabinet bringing in 7 ex-rebel chiefs as ministers. According to the French news agency AFP, Hamdok dissolved the previous cabinet on Sunday to make way for a more inclusive lineup in government. 2 ministers were selected from the military, with the remaining coming from the Forces for Freedom and Change group, which played a key role in Sudan's politics. This group was the driving force behind anti-government protests that led to the April 2019 ouster of longtime strongman Omar al-Bashir. Hamdok named as foreign minister Mariam al-Sadi al-Mahdi, daughter of the late Sadiq al-Mahdi. The last democratically elected prime minister was toppled by Bashir in a 1989 Islamist-backed military coup. Veteran rebel leader and economist Jibril Ibrahim of the Justice and Equality Movement, which played a role in the Darfur conflict, was appointed finance minister. Hamdok says the new cabinet will help preserve the country from collapse. A new study by aid agency Doctors Without Borders at the University of Geneva shows that insulin can be stored at warmer temperatures, making it easier for people with diabetes to live in places without reliable access to refrigeration. The study concluded that strict cold storage recommendations for insulin are difficult to follow in tropical regions and even more challenging in conflict and humanitarian emergency settings, adding an extra burden for people managing diabetes. For more, International Edition Chiriduo 4 spoke with Dr. Philippe Boulay, MSF Non-Communicable Disease Advisor.
People don't have access to refrigeration in very many parts of the world, meant that either clinicians were reluctant to give them insulin to take home, and so often insulin was being stored in health services, in hospitals, and patients were forced to come to the hospital twice a day or more to receive their insulin. In our settings, we saw that patients were having to travel very long distances, sometimes even having to therefore stay all day at the hospital, every day of their lives, in order to receive their insulin injections. And other patients, we had a couple of examples where sort of part of the family, the child and one parent, were even relocating to live near the hospital.
What does this new report mean for those patients who have had a difficult time accessing or even keeping the efficacy of insulin?
It gives us a lot more confidence to be able to give patients insulin to take home where the temperatures are higher than kind of normal 25 degrees. Of course, we always then recommend that they store it in locally made cooling containers. It needs to be stored, of course, out of direct heat. But it really just removes this barrier because we know that it should be safe and perfectly efficacious. What we saw was we were looking at fluctuating temperatures up to 37 degrees, but just in general, a lot more confidence that, you know, clinicians shouldn't see lack of refrigeration and hot temperatures as a barrier to prescribing insulin for their patients. And really, people living with diabetes absolutely should have a fundamental right to be injecting their own insulin and able to try and live as normal a life as possible. And this makes that more feasible.
Now, what do you make of comments by critics that unless better explained to the public, a lot of people might think you just take your insulin home and you don't even have to refrigerate it, and that might defeat the purpose of this study?
this is something where what we want is to be a strong and clear consensus statement from different organizations, you know, reputable organizations involved in diabetes care and really hopefully led or endorsed by the WHO so that we can really make these instructions clear. It's just a case of trying to explain it properly. I understand the concern around that. I think it's very valid and I think we need to address it. But I absolutely don't think that we can go backwards because of that fear. We absolutely need to go forwards and make insulin more available to people who need it. Globally around the world, 50% of those who require insulin don't have it. We need to start removing all the barriers to that. This is one barrier, and we need to see how to move forward, removing this barrier so we can address some of the other ones.
That was Dr. Philippa Boulay, MSF Non-Communicable Disease Advisor, speaking with VOA's Chiniduo 4. The hard lockdowns to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in Zimbabwe have pushed the poor into starvation, with families struggling even to put a meal a day on the table. Rutende Mawera reports from Harare.
The Zimbabwe government reintroduced a hard lockdown on January 5 after increases in COVID-19 cases and deaths. The lockdown was extended to 15 February, and some medical experts warn that without a vaccination plan in place, the government may extend the lockdown. Those who earn their livings on informal trading say life has become very difficult, and human rights groups are calling on the government to provide social safety nets for the vulnerable. Primrose Shava, who is a school graduate, survived on buying and selling before the lockdown because she could not get a formal job. She says life is now unbearable and she's struggling to put food on the table for her two children.
We have been in lockdown for too long without hustling. Our government just locked us down, knowing very well that we live from hand to mouth. I was a cross-border trader and now I have no food for me and my children.
Amos Mukandapi, who also used to sell his wares in Harare Central Business District, says some days he fails to even provide a single meal for his family.
I have been operating as a vendor for quite some time now, and it has been my only source of income in order to survive and provide for my family. But now, due to these lockdown restrictions and extensions, I can't do it anymore. And I think it's not good for the government to just impose these lockdown restrictions and extensions without providing assistance for its citizens.
A church leader from Chegudu said the lockdowns have affected their ability to help congregants. The pastor, who wanted to remain anonymous, says the lockdown barred them from providing psychosocial support that church members desperately need during this pandemic period.
We have also people come to us for food assistance, but because we don't have, it's very difficult for us to help them because we don't have anything to offer. And we plead with our government that if they could look into this issue of lockdown, and maybe also look at how they can actually have safety social nets to assist even people in this time. Not only that, but we feel as a church it's an essential service. They are there to give hope. Psychologically, people need comfort and help in times like this.
An umbrella body for human rights and civic organizations, Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition, says the continued lockdowns without providing help for the vulnerable is a catastrophe. The spokesperson for the group, Mavela Skumalo, called on government to provide help immediately.
The restrictions make it very, very difficult for them to continue with their day-to-day businesses, thereby creating a difficult situation for them because they cannot continue to have the capacity to fend for their families and to put food on their tables. So we had expected that the government, through different institutions, will chip in and make sure that it provides social safety nets for these suffering and vulnerable members of the community. But government has remained mum on this issue. This has created a very precarious position for most of the people, who are now faced with the negative effects of COVID-19, as well as the threats of starvation.
Human rights groups say the failure to help the poor has resulted in thousands of citizens being arrested for breaking the COVID-19 regulations. The Zimbabwe Republic Police have arrested nearly 404,000 people since the initial lockdown on 30 March 2020 for violating COVID-19 regulations. In his address to the nation, end of January, President Emmerson Mnangagwa admitted that people were suffering from the effects of the lockdown and needed government assistance. He promised that help would be coming, but so far, the government has not begun any new aid programs. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
Zimbabwe's often arrested anti-corruption journalist, Hopewell Chinono, has turned to protest music as a song he released on social media goes viral. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the song, Damn Loot, has also been covered by other artists and linked in numerous posts. But some are warning Chinono may be arrested for it.
Lord of them loot, them loot, them loot, them loot. Hospitals, no medication, them loot.
Hopo Chingono is singing to Zimbabwean youths, corruption is the cause of the country's poor economy and the average citizen's poverty. Several versions of the song, set to a reggae beat, have been released since its launch, and fans have posted their amateur videos. Chingono, who until now was known as a journalist, says he's happy with the development. He has an emphatic no to critics who say he's now getting into politics.
I think we have a role in society as citizens to ask the most important and pertinent questions. It's not just about the song. The song is an entry point into the Zimbabwean discourse where people now talk about why is it there is a broken state in Zimbabwe? Why is it the roads are bad? Why is it people don't have clean drinking water? Why is it 95% of Zimbabwe's potential workforce is not going to work?
President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government has arrested Chinono 3 times since July on charges that he abused social media and not for speaking out against corruption. Tendai Chirau, youth spokesman for the ruling ZANU-PF party, says Chinono saying just to get sympathy ahead of his pending trial and not to oppose corruption.
Any talk of corruption without taking evidence to the institutions responsible for fighting corruption, like ZAC and the courts, is mere grandstanding. And we call that anyone in Zimbabwe who has any evidence of any corrupt activity to approach the responsible institutions.
ZAC is the Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission, which has arrested several politicians for graft. But the critics say it's mainly targeting enemies of President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Alexander Rusero is a former senior journalism and international relations lecturer at Harare Polytechnic College. He says he is not surprised by the way the government and its sympathizers have condemned Chinono's song.
Opo's messages have since proved to be effective because of the wider audience, the wider reach in terms of fighting corruption, government-instigated corruption. And the government is frustrated because it does not have strategies and methodologies of countering such an effective method where information about corruption is relayed at an alarming and faster pace than any other time before.
Dem loot, dem loot, dem loot, dem loot, Harisaima PPE, dem loot.
Dem loot has attracted hundreds of thousands of views and comments on social media. As fans continue to enjoy the song, some are warning Chinono through their versions that he may go back to jail because of it. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kihayis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international